Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
One hates to get all bogged down in technicalities on a Friday, but the White House did something remarkable this morning. Never mind the official policy of 57 years of communism. The Commerce Department said as far as the United States is concerned, China is now a market economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 30th of March today, and we'll grant you that on the face of it, the announcement this Friday morning from the Commerce Department didn't sound like much. The U.S. is slapping tariffs on imports of some paper products from China because, the administration said, they're unfairly subsidized. So far, just run-of-the-mill trade policy. Hold on a second, though, because for decades, Washington's looked the other way when developing economies gave their domestic manufacturers a helping hand. That was before the White House came under fire from U.S. industries and congressional Democrats. So the Bush administration has decided China's not a government-run, non-market economy anymore. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The Commerce Department says imports of Chinese sheet paper increased 177% over the last 2 years. The U.S. says Chinese government subsidies help make their paper cheaper. Commerce Secretary Carlos Gutierrez says now that China is a player in the global economy and is beginning to make free market innovations, it's time they played by the rules.
China is a rising economic power, and the U.S. welcomes the innovation and efficiencies that result when our companies and industries compete.
The duties will add as much as 20% to the price of Chinese paper. The Commerce Department's turnaround comes after a complaint filed by an Ohio papermaker that its Chinese competitors unfairly benefit from special tax breaks and government-subsidized loans. University of Pennsylvania China expert Jacques Delisle says if these proposed sanctions are approved, paper will only be the beginning.
Once you open the floodgates to countervailing duty claims, which attach much larger penalties, in effect, than anti-dumping duties do, then a lot of industries will follow on, and you will see furniture companies and textile companies and consumer goods companies quite possibly piling on.
And quite possibly resulting in a trade war, especially if China decides to push back with its own retaliatory sanctions. But Delisle says there are plenty of industries on both sides that benefit from barrier-free trade and will lobby against the proposed duties. A final ruling is due before mid-October. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Sometimes you have to read between the lines to figure out what's going on, as was the case with that China announcement today. Other times, it's right there in black and white. Dell Computer says an internal accounting investigation has uncovered evidence of misconduct. Add to that the fact that the Securities and Exchange Commission is poking around the company's books, and you've got just about enough information to make investors really nervous. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Dell has not clarified what kind of misconduct has been uncovered, and that's left stock analysts guessing. How bad are the skeletons in Dell's closet? Morningstar analyst Rick Hanna says the company is giving investors little to go on.
They haven't filed a quarterly report for over 3 quarters now. Think about an analogy. We're kind of driving in the fog, and it's hard to see very far in front of you because there's not a lot of light that's being shed on the situation.
Morningstar rates management practices at various companies, and Hanna says
they grade relatively poorly, quite frankly.
On the Morningstar report card, Dell's management gets a D. In terms of consumer satisfaction, the company isn't looking so hot either. A new survey shows Dell is losing PC customers to other brands. Analyst Gary Arlen is president of Arlen Communications.
There's a sense that Compaq and HP, which are owned by the same company, are really picking up market share and market interest. So Dell has a lot to do both on the marketing front as well as the financial front.
Taken together, Dell might not seem like a very attractive stock, but despite the dark clouds, Morningstar analyst Rick Hanna says the business model is solid and the stock is undervalued.
As an example, they've probably got close to $5, $6 a share just in cash sitting on the books. They're still incredibly financially healthy. I mean, this is still a very, very solid, very strong company.
On a rating of 1 to 5 stars, Morningstar still gives Dell its strongest recommendation, 5 stars. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Dell investors got off relatively easy today, considering the new shares down almost 0.8%. Otherwise, it was every which way but up for investors as they tried to figure out where the economy's headed. We'll have the details and we'll look at the whole week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. More than the highly paid consultants or any spinmeister you can think of, the most important people in any presidential campaign this weekend are the accountants. They're squeezing every last nickel out of donors and massaging the books in only the most legal way, of course, to make the war chest seem as big as possible. Tomorrow at midnight's the deadline to report first quarter contributions and win or lose a big part of the PR fight. As Marketplace's Steve Henn explains, raising a lot of money early can help build momentum. And in a field crowded with political stars, the pressure to produce early eye-popping totals has been unusually intense.
Oh, wait.
What do we have here?
Oh, it's calamari with a wasabi dipping sauce, horseradish sauce. It's awfully good.
This is the sound of America's first presidential primary. It's the money race, and it's taking place in the living rooms of America's millionaires.
I'm the chairman of the Senate Banking and Housing Committee of the United States Senate, and part of my job is to try and visit Section 8 housing when I travel, and I just want to...
Last night, Senator Christopher Dodd was schmoozing big donors poolside in Pacific Palisades, California, a long way from public housing projects. The name of the game is big donors and fast.
We're going to see an enormous spike in the amount of money that's been raised.
That's Tony Corrado, a campaign finance expert at Colby College.
If we look at the first quarter in 2003, there was $31 million in all raised by all of the candidates. I expect in this election cycle we're going to see 4 to 5 times that amount in the first quarter.
Corrado says half a dozen serious presidential candidates from both parties are in danger of being forced out of this race before a single vote is cast. That includes senators, governors, and cabinet secretaries. Today, they are all candidates on the bubble. Dodd is hoping to stay in the game.
You know, I think he's an extraordinary man.
His host last night was TV mogul Tom Werner. Werner's friends kicked in $200,000 for Dodd. Dodd hopes to raise at least $30 million for his presidential bid. By the end of the day tomorrow, he will need to have at least $7 million in the bank just to stay credible, according to his own campaign.
First of all, I don't support every Democratic candidate, but this is not a huge amount of money for me.
Werner says he's a huge Dodd fan, but lately he's been spreading his money around, giving it to multiple presidential candidates. Evan Tracy tracks campaign spending for the Campaign Media Analysis Group. He's never seen a money frenzy like this.
We've moved into a different stratosphere.
4 years ago, the kind of money Dodd is shooting for would have put him among the front runners. This year, Tracy says he's clearly second tier and hoping to stay in the game long enough to catch fire.
I think all said and done that the top tier candidates are going to need to raise between $70 and $100 million to be competitive throughout this process. Obviously, you can play with less money, but you're putting yourself at a severe disadvantage.
One reason is Super Duper Tuesday. On February 5th next year, up to 22 states could hold their presidential primaries, including some whoppers like California, Florida, and New York. That means campaigns flush with cash could start buying national ad time or airing ads in places like California as early as this summer. Evan Tracy.
What they will spend total on Iowa TV will be barely enough to buy them a week worth of California.
In mid-April, when the election filings become public, we'll see which candidates can afford to compete. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
Time to check the week on Wall Street with our stockbroker and business analyst guy down in Dallas, David Johnson. David, how are you?
I feel like I've been running a 401k.
Oh, yeah. 401k, very funny. Yeah, you're breaking my heart, but it was kind of a busy week, I guess.
Oh, it's been an exhausting week. It's really been, it really has taken its toll. You know, the end result is nothing. I mean, we lost a little bit of ground for the week. Today, I mean, today was a great example. You know, this the Dow traded within a 174-point range today alone?
Yes, but here's the rub. It was not 174 points from 0 to 174. It was up and then down and then up and then down. I mean, nobody could make up their minds today.
No, I know. And today was, all the excuse was, you know, trade sanctions against the Chinese or some worries about a trade war that might or might not take place. Mm-hmm. But it's just that kind of a market. It's a really spooky market. And I tell you what it goes back to. You remember Tuesday afternoon, and actually you may not remember exactly because you were on the air, but while you were on the air and I was talking to the producers, I said, oil's up $8 a barrel, the stock market futures are dropping like a rock, something's going on. You remember that?
Yeah, I do. I remember. I got out of the studio and they told me you'd
call. Well, the thing is we couldn't trace it down, and that's because nothing had happened. There was a rumor in the commodities market that a U.S. ship was fired upon by the Iranians. There was another rumor that that U.K. made some sort of incursion in to try to get their people out. But you know what it did? You ever have a bad dream, a dream so bad that when you wake up first thing in the morning, you know it didn't really happen, but you kind of think maybe it might have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes a little while to get it out of your mind.
And sometimes, you know, it kind of stays with you all day long and maybe even a little bit the next day. You just can't quite. That's what that moment was like, is suddenly I think the market said, oh, no, and now we understand we could have $100 oil like a shot, literally like a shot, and that is very unnerving.
All right, but then this morning, I mean, talk to me about this China tariffs thing. I mean, the market drops, you know, 60 points, 100 points off the bat as soon as Carlos Gutierrez opens his mouth.
It's just skittish. It's very skittish, and that's my point. And I'm telling you that lingering concern about something happening out there. Now, added to it, you add to the fact that this is the end of the quarter. Today, in fact, was the last day of the quarter. And you get a lot of gyrations. You get a lot of squirrely stuff. In fact, there's nothing. I've been doing this 35 years, and every once in a while I get to see a few things that I haven't seen before. This morning, I thought I was seeing that Eddie Murphy movie, you know, Trading Places.
Yeah, what part of it?
Well, do you remember the end of it? And the whole thing, the whole plot of the movie hinges on the crop report, and they're trying to corner the orange juice. Well, this morning, the crop report was on corn futures. And the crop report was trying to tell us how many acres farmers were going to plant in corn. Now, this is a big deal because of ethanol. It's been created this enormous demand for corn and everything else. And corn futures fell 5%. Didn't have anything to do with the stock market, but you had stock market people talking about the crop report. You know what we need? You know what we need? We need a four-day week.
Which I think you get next week somehow, and yet I don't.
I didn't mean to rub that
in. How is that possible?
Well,
fair?
We work harder.
Yeah, no, I don't think so. Just because you're huffing and puffing at the beginning of the talk doesn't mean you're actually working.
Oh, thank goodness for the weekend.
All right.
Have a good one.
There we go. David, you too. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. We'll talk to you next week. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials rose 5 points today, basically flat, to close at 12,354. For the week, the Dow fell about 1%. The Nasdaq edged up 3 points, more than a tenth of a percent, to finish at 2421. For the past 5 days, the Nasdaq was down 1.1%. The S&P 500 declined 1 point, about a tenth of a percent, to end at 1420. The S&P 500 slipped more than a percent Monday through Friday. The world's biggest ethanol producer, Archer Daniels Midland, wilted more than a percent today, despite news that farmers are cashing in on the fuel ethanol boom by planting more corn than at any time since World War II. But it was a healthier day for vaccine company Dandreon. The Food and Drug Administration declared the company's new drug for prostate cancer safe and effective. Dandreon's stock shot up more than 147% today. Oil fell 0.2% today, $65.87 a barrel in New York. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, managing money with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. Results of the annual National Airline Quality Rating are announced at the National Press Club. Passover begins at sundown. And got a comment on eating cloned animals? You've got until April 2nd to submit it to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They're seeking feedback on the sale of food made from cloned cattle, pigs, and goats. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Have a great weekend.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Mars Company rolled out a $20 million ad campaign this week. Not for its more familiar products like M&M's or Snickers. It's pushing rice, Uncle Ben's. Except he's not just Uncle Ben anymore. He's the chairman of the board now. The idea was to update a 60-year-old image loaded down with racial baggage. But Marketplace's Amy Scott reports that makeover is getting some mixed reviews.
On Uncle Ben's new website, you can tour the character's office. The new Uncle Ben presides over a massive oak desk. His daily calendar is full of important appointments. But smiling down from a gold-framed portrait on the wall is the same bow-tied gentleman the company has emblazoned on its products for decades.
They're trying to elevate this character, this icon, from a place of subservience to a place of control and power.
Marilyn Kern Foxworth wrote about Uncle Ben in a book about African Americans in advertising. She says he was a real guy, a rice farmer not connected with the company. The picture, though, was of a restaurant maitre d' named Frank Brown. 60 years later, Kern Foxworth says the image connotes servant or porter, not the head of a company. Al Anderson is CEO of Anderson Communications. The company specializes in marketing to African Americans.
There are African Americans who are the chairman of the board. They don't have on string bow ties, okay? They have on business suits just like any other CEO.
And they probably don't go by aunt or uncle so-and-so, another vestige of discrimination. Anderson says Mars might have done better to follow Aunt Jemima's lead. A makeover almost 20 years ago slimmed down the former mammy caricature, took away the bandana, and added pearls. Anderson says if Uncle Ben had just switched ties, most customers probably wouldn't have noticed, and it wouldn't have cost $20 million. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Foreign policy and scandal have been sucking up most of the oxygen in Washington for a while now. So we haven't really heard much about the president's old domestic priorities, like the debate about what to do with Social Security. Even if Congress and the White House are busy with the war and what to do about the U.S. attorney's scandal, baby boomers aren't getting any younger. And some people are thinking about how to keep the program and the U.S. government solvent. Author Christopher Buckley is one of them. Welcome to the program, Mr. Buckley.
Good to be here.
This is an interesting proposal you have, sir. Describe it for us, would you?
The proposal is that the government incentivize suicide among retiring baby boomers in order to save the Social Security system from collapse.
Suicide?
Well, we don't call it that. We call it voluntary transitioning. We think that is a more palatable term for mass suicide. But if you want to prefer to call it mass suicide, go ahead.
Well, I and certainly many others will. How would you incentivize people to do this?
Well, Kai, the idea is fairly straightforward. If you pledge to voluntarily transition at, say, age 65, the government offers tax incentives. For instance, you would be exempt from estate tax. The later you agree to transition, of course, the fewer incentives the government can offer. Now, I'm frequently asked what happens if people who agree to transition then balk when they turn 65 or 70, say, no, you know, I've changed my mind. So the proposal does have substantial penalties for refusal to withdraw.
Play out for me the larger economic effects of what might happen. You pass this law,
what happens to the stock market the next day? I bet it drops 10,000 points.
Well, no, actually, Kai, the whole idea is to preserve the economic system. 77 million baby boomers are going to start retiring in 2008. That's going to have a calamitous impact on the Social Security system. Additionally, the government finances this by borrowing from overseas banks. The moment those banks decide they have bought enough U.S. debt, then we're in bad trouble. So the voluntary transitioning proposal really is designed as a solution to all that.
We should probably right about here let you off the hook, don't you think? Would you feel better if we did that?
I sure would.
All right.
I'm sweating bullets here thinking people are actually going to think this is serious.
But you did a great job. You are, of course, Christopher Buckley. You have a new book coming out called Boomsday, in which you satirically propose this. I guess the heart of all good political satire is an element of truth, that there's some big, you know, problem coming our way when all these baby boomers retire.
Well, yeah. The hardest part of writing satire in America is that you're in competition with tomorrow's front page. And who's you know, who's to say someone won't actually propose something like this? But the plot of the book grew out of a genuine concern about our government's refusal serially to address this fiscal insolvency. And this thing is going to bite us in the... In the you-know-where if we don't do something about it. This is a this novel is sort of an attempt to, it's an attempt to pay next month's mortgage in my case. That's really the best argument for writing a book. But, it is a comic novel about Social Security reform.
I'm reading the About the Author page of the book. I have it in front of me here. It says, Christopher Buckley was born in New York City in 1952. That means, if I do the math right, you get to retire in 2017. I mean, this is, you're voluntarily transition, I think you might say. You're part of the problem, I guess.
Yes, Kai, but you see, here's the really clever part. If millions and millions of people buy this book, I might be able to retire sooner. And if that happens, I hereby pledge to forego my Social Security payments. So I think the whole country really should pull together and buy this book and solve at least one part of the Social Security crisis.
Christopher Buckley's latest book is called Boomsday. It's a novel. I'll say that again. It's absolutely fiction. Mr. Buckley, thanks a lot for your time.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Think about the date, everybody. We're a couple of days early, but happy April Fools all the same. The troubled Tribune Company finds itself in the enviable middle of a bidding war today. Two Los Angeles billionaires have raised their offer for the corporate parent of the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune. Like a lot of newspaper companies, Tribune's been fighting a losing battle against falling profits, lower circulation, and disappearing advertising revenue. But Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports plain old newsprint can still be an attractive investment.
The New York Times would like you to believe otherwise. But even in this age of media consolidation, the Big Apple is no one newspaper town. There are two tabloids. There's Newsday. There's even competition between the freebie papers that get handed out during the morning rush hour.
Metro, 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 last call.
And there's a whole host of community papers that cover neighborhoods throughout the five boroughs and the suburbs. It's that last bunch that's been getting a lot of attention lately. Last fall, Rupert Murdoch's News Corp, which owns the tabloid New York Post, bought up a chain of weeklies in Queens and another in Brooklyn. Now, rumor has it, the media mogul's looking to nab another one in the Bronx. These are papers whose biggest front page headlines wouldn't merit a brief in the Times Metro section. So why would anyone want to buy them? Michael Schenkler publishes the free weekly Queens Tribune. He gestures out the window toward two of his biggest advertisers, a local bank and a geriatric care facility.
They get their response from us. Queens County Savings Bank gets to their readers not through advertising on CNN, not through buying a box on Yahoo. not through Google Ads.
That audience helps push his ad revenue up by about 10% a year. And he says his small young staff knows Queens like nobody else. Major metro dailies are stretching themselves thin to cover wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, or shutting down bureaus to save money. People like Shankler can comfortably cover the pothole on 179th Street that never seems to get fixed. Miles Groves is an economist who studies the news business. He says smaller local newspapers are thriving across the country.
They don't have the challenges their big newspaper brethren have. They don't have the competitive issues. And within their respective communities, they're really more vital.
That's not to say life is easy for community papers. Like the big dailies, they've seen a drop in their classifieds. Still, Shankler says, there are times when local prevails over digital.
You're not going on the World Wide Web to look for a carpenter because you're going to find one in Cleveland, Ohio. You're going to find one in San Francisco.
What you want is the one who worked on your neighbor's house down the street. Of course, success is also relative. Local publishers may be thrilled with a 10% return on their investment, while Wall Street expects much more. So what's all this mean for the small papers being gobbled up by big corporations? Tom Allen is president-elect of the New York Press Association and publisher of several community papers and magazines in Manhattan. He says the answer's in the execution.
If they keep the local managers and the people that have been running the business and making it successful and don't try to squeeze the margins, then I think those things can continue to thrive and grow.
But, he says, dailies are just as good as any other corporation at messing things up. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, if you happen to be listening last Monday, you might have heard me take a ride in a $250,000 Ferrari. 9 miles to the gallon, I think, but there was a very different kind of car on display in Washington today. 4 biodiesels are about to set off on the first annual Greaseball Challenge from D.C. down to Costa Rica. They're not exactly sporty. One's a 1976 Mercedes with some mold on the inside. The 4,500-mile trip is funded in part by the Inter-American Development Bank and the Hard Rock Cafe. The drivers will fuel up at that chain and at other restaurants along the way, wherever they can get their hands on some old grease, I suppose. Their first tank full, however, was generously donated by the World Bank's cafeteria, which I'm told had samosas on the menu. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. It was a rumor-filled week on Wall Street. The Dow gained 5 points today. That's basically flat. The Nasdaq rose 3 points, 0.1%. The S&P 500 lost a point. That's about 0.1% there as well. For the week, everything was down about 1% across the board. Turns out you can take it with you. We've got a podcast now if you missed the show on the radio. The link's at our website. It's marketplace.org. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yor. Coming up on Monday, where do geeks go to get away?
I didn't think I could sell the Big Nerd Monastery, so we came up with the idea of the Big Nerd Ranch.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.